Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 104.
104.
That's German.
Well, I think it's officially been 5 years of podcasting.
Wow.
Is, or is it 6 years of podcasting?
I don't know.
We started in 2015.
15 to 16, 16, 17, 18, 18, 19, 19 to 20, 20 to 21. That's 6 years.
That doesn't seem possible.
Well, I don't know. You said we started, what month did we start in 2015?
April 20th.
So it's been 6 years.
I know. Hard to believe.
Oh my God. We've been doing this for 6 years. You'd think you'd have more than 104 podcast episodes, but whatever. We weren't consistent.
No, and this is a thing we do because we love it. But turns out, you know, now Apple's letting us charge for these podcasts. So maybe at some point in the future, we'll start doing exclusive things or teasers or try to make it into something more. But it's been a really fun journey talking to loads of people.
Wow, 6 year anniversary. Crazy. Who was your favorite person to interview so far?
Oh, that's a really hard one to answer. I'd definitely say Cedric Walker, who was our previous episode, is up there with my absolute favorite people to interview. One of our first interviews, Salama Wabi, was a big highlight for me. The Shayna Carroll episode, I think, is really great. She had some great advice for you and I as far as working together as a couple. What about you? Any other highlights?
Oh, geez. I mean, I do feel like Cedric Walker was like someone I've been wanting to talk to since pre-podcast when I first saw Universal. It was like the second circus we saw together. I was like, who made this circus? Like, I want to talk to them. So I think that was a real win for me personally. And I also would say, I'm glad we got Paul Binder when we did, because I feel like he's such a big crux of American circus landscape. And it was prior to Big Apple going, bankrupt, and kind of what a moment of circus history. So I kind of feel like I'm happy we got him too.
Well, here's to many more years of doing it. You know, as always, we start off with a chat about what's happening in circus right now. There's been a lot of things happening. A few things just to pop off right off the top. Cirque du Soleil has announced the return of O and of Mystère. Later this summer, the casts have been announced, so those will be the first two shows back in Las Vegas. Cirque Mechanics, also a Las Vegas company, just did a weekend of outdoor shows, which were pretty much sold out and a big success. So I think that's a great indicator for audiences wanting to come back and for people who were doing outdoor shows. New York, you know, things are still pretty slow here, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few like cabarets here and there, but the rule is you have to serve food with, I think it's kind of like you have to have food with drinks, but then you also have to have food if you want performances. I don't know. It's a little confusing. So, I mean, it's challenging, but there's a few things, but not like the rest of the country.
Well, probably the biggest thing that's going to be talked about for the next month, I'm guessing, is the newly formed American Circus Alliance. Kind of odd to say newly formed since it's been meeting now for over a year, but it's being publicly launched and people will be able to join it.
So American Circus Alliance, what does this new group of alliances, I don't know, people in the alliance, what's the goal? What's the mission? What's kind of the ethos of this new group?
Well, it's essentially an advocacy organization. So it's loads of different people who are circus practitioners, producers, directors, performers, educators, designers, who have been meeting regularly on conference calls to chat about what's going on in the industry. But the idea is really to find a way to have a unified voice to advocate for things. So the first big thing they're doing is a Be an Arts Hero letter. So many different arts industries, theater, dance, have signed a letter to President Biden and Kamala Harris asking them to have a Secretary of Arts and Culture and give more funding to the arts and to recognize circus as an art form. So it's the first time, I think, at least any time recently, where there's been a real concerted effort by a large group of people in the industry to try to have a unified voice. Of course, because of coronavirus, everybody had the time to spend focusing on this and talking with one another. And now I think after a year, they're the people who are running it. It's the board of different folks, many of which have been past podcast guests. You can find out who they are on their website, have decided to open it up to everybody to join. So I believe tomorrow, Thursday, April 22nd is the official launch date. And there's an Eventbrite that you can go and they'll explain to everybody what the ACA is.
It's great. I think always coming together as a group and having a unified voice and a place to talk and discuss things is awesome. It's funny. I've been on these calls for people, specifically women in the Broadway League. And I'm not a part of the Broadway League, but everyone on the call mostly is. And it's similar to, in a way, to the Circus Alliance, because it's a group of all the theater producers in New York who are coming together as a voice and trying to lead through the pandemic, but also just in general with unions and openings and just kind of like having a group of people where you can continually talk and have a clear understanding of what's going on. The problem that has been happening with the Broadway League is that the people at the top, you know, let's say 10 people who are like the people who run it and the executive board aren't communicating openly with the rest of the members. And I think that's kind of where you can run a little bit of risk with these kind of groups, because I think sometimes it's like the heads of the group know a lot, have a lot of information, and then it's never dispersed totally to the rest of the people. So it'll be interesting to see how the Circus Alliance goes, because there's so many different types of circus industry people in a way that there isn't in Broadway. The Broadway is very specifically in New York in this box of theaters, you know, it's very clear, and that has a lot of problems with transparency. So I think it's awesome that it's happening, because it should be happening. It should we should have a group of people who are all communicating in the country. It's awesome. But I also am a little worried of like the cohesion of message and what, who knows what, who's a part of what. So I don't know. It's interesting.
No, I think you're spot on there. I will say that the folks who've been running it have done a really good job so far in making things group decisions. It definitely has not felt like it's a small group of people making decisions in a back room. But kind of like what you're saying, my anxiety with things that are large groups is when a large group makes any kind of statement and my name is somehow attached to it and I didn't make the statement myself. And that's why we like doing the podcast, because we can say whatever we think and you're hearing it straight from our voices. And whenever you're part of a union or a large organizational group like this, those groups act in the benefit of the group, not the individual. So if you have an individual problem or an individual need, doesn't necessarily mean it will get addressed or fixed. But I do think it's very important for when there are opportunities that other kinds of art industries get, because they have some kind of league or group promoting them and advocating for them. Circus has not really had that. They have different kinds of things. There's the Circus Producers Association. There's ICO. There's ACE. So they don't have nothing, but I don't think there's anything specifically like this. So definitely want people listening to the pod, particularly if you're an American artist or you work in the U.S., to go check them out. You can follow them on Instagram, the American Circus Alliance, and sign up to find out more.
Yeah, and you know, just to play devil's advocate also of the statements and being a part of a group statement, I understand what you're saying, but there also is such power in numbers. So even if the statement isn't totally written by you, the fact that you are supporting a general statement in a positive way towards moving circus forward, I think is important. You know, even if it's not exactly what you would say or the way you would say it, or, you know, you being the collective, you, not just you, Josh Avener, but in general, because I have this problem too, because, you know, the group I'm on is trying to maybe write a letter to, you know, something. And it's like, do I want my name on it if I didn't personally write it? And I think the answer is yes, because the ultimate goal is all the same, is to move forward, to make circus arts a recognized field in the United States. And that is a positive thing. One thing that's not a positive thing in Broadway recently, but in the sense of positivity of calling these practices that are terrible, that have been going on for years, out to hopefully have change. Scott Rudin, who is a producer, big, 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 massive, massive producer on Broadway and in movies, but not so much recently, really on Broadway. He produces all the shows with like the big celebrities. So we did To Kill a Mockingbird, Hello Dolly, I mean, really,
Book of Mormon.
But yeah,
and as far
Book
as movies, because many people might not have been to New York, The Social Network, No Country for Old Men. Like, if it's a star-driven project, he's very often attached to it. He's like a Harvey Weinstein type person who's famous for being angry and an extremely powerful producer on the East and West Coast.
Right. So an article came out about 2 weeks ago where 119, I think, of his past employees, assistants, his personal assistants, came out and spoke out against Scott Rudin. He's abusive verbally, physically. He'll like smash a computer on someone's hand. He threw staplers at someone. I mean, there's a lot of
countless stories,
countless stories. But what's interesting for me and Josh when we read this article was this isn't new. We have known about him and his volatility. It's been a thing in the industry for years and years and years. Since at least 2013 when we started hearing conversations.
Longer than that, because when I was at NYU, I saw job postings for working in his office and they were saying things like, you must have thick skin in the job posting.
So it's not new, right? And that's the problem. It's like everyone just accepted it and is like, this is because he makes a lot of money
for everyone.
For everyone, especially for theater owners, for the actors in his shows. You know, he definitely employs a lot of people. So it's, I think, one of those things that people kind of like let slide. But finally, this group, again, going back to the power of numbers and voices, this group of personal assistants came out. Someone wrote the article from the Hollywood Reporter and exposed him. And what's also the most interesting is in the story that we should all be watching, other than the abuse, which obviously is terrible, and he's quote unquote stepped back, which honestly, like, what does that even mean? Because he can step back and not be in the public. But unless he steps back from managing and running financially all his LLCs of all the shows he's a part of, he's really still a part of it. But I digress. The biggest story is also that Spotco, which is a advertising and marketing agency, which we did mention, I think, when it came out, he still owes them $6.3 or $6.4 million. That's a lot of money for a Broadway advertising marketing agency to be floating. Why Spotco let it go on that long? Unclear. Where is the money that Scott Rudin owes them? Unclear, because it's coming from shows. So I think that'll be, if there is a downfall in this story, a true big downfall, it'll be the Spotco lawsuit.
Well, I think it's like, how much repercussion can somebody have for being a really shitty boss and an asshole? And the answer is like, it's kind of limited, probably, until you're really doing things that are easily provable as abuse or harassment. And even then, it's like a little unclear what the punishment necessarily would be. So as people say, I think we got to follow the money. I think this Spotco thing is still actually where the story is. And there's a lot left to come out about Scott Rudin. So,
yeah. And I mean, one good thing is that about him being called out is like, it's not just him who's being a dick. You know, like I worked for I will not name his name, but a Broadway producer for I think a week before I quit, and he was super verbally abusive, made me sit in a broken chair on purpose, made me say his name to him like 12 or 13 times in a row. And he's like, say my name. It was very weird.
I was like, quit. After the first day, I was like, quit. Just don't go in tomorrow. Who gives a shit?
And then you're like, oh, I don't want to burn a bridge. Like, who cares? You know, like, this person's a horrible person, and it's not like he's impacted my life ever by quitting. So I think, you know, it's great that it's finally being spoken about. He's not the only one. I always feel a little like pessimistic because I'm like, is anything actually going to change? Because I don't know. I feel a little bit jaded at this point. I hope things change. But I think if anything's going to change, it's going to be the money lawsuit. And that's what's actually going to get Scott Rudin out. We'll see.
We'll give you an update on that as it happens. Today's episode is actually really good if you're interested in the business of circus, the business of theater, what it takes to go from a performer to a director to a producer. We're interviewing James Tanabe, who is a man who wears many hats, an incredibly talented performer in his own right, got an MBA, worked for Cirque du Soleil, worked and created his own projects. He really has so many different skills and things he's experienced. It's a really interesting conversation that goes into a lot of depth, both about how one manages the artistic side of a circus business and the production side.
James is super smart. Sometimes I talk to people and they're just so smart and I'm like, oh my God, Am I this, like, I wish I was this smart. He really knows his stuff. It's very rare, I think, to also talk to people who have a real foot and knowledge in both the performing side and the business side. And he is one of those people. I loved talking to him.
And, you know, I think we said a couple episodes back, like, who on earth is qualified to run something like Cirque du Soleil? Don't tell them, but I think we might have found someone.
I know, after the podcast, Josh was like, he should be running Cirque du Soleil. And, you know, I agree. But, you know, who knows if he wants to, whatever. So anyway, if you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. And without further ado, here is our interview with James.
James, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm really excited to chat with you. Where are we reaching you at the moment?
I'm currently in Berlin.
But you're not, you don't sound like you're German. Are you originally from Berlin?
No. I just relocated here right before COVID hit, actually. So I've been living here for almost exactly 1 year now.
Wow. You literally moved right before everything shut down.
Just snuck in right before everything locked down, got my residency and everything. So the timing couldn't have been more perfect.
And where are you from originally?
I was born in Minnesota, grew up in Tokyo, and then did university the East Coast of the US and circus school in Montreal, and then did most of my work in Asia before returning to Montreal with Cirque du Soleil. And now I'm in Europe, so it's been sort of jumping around constantly ever since I was a little kid, actually.
I am from Boston, and I love whenever anyone says, I went to school in the East Coast, and, you know, in Boston, it's either MIT or Harvard. Well, you know, like, I went to BU, I went to BC, but it's like, I went to school in the Boston area, like Harvard or MIT. How was MIT experience for you?
MIT was fantastic. I think that what I wasn't expecting, or what most people are surprised to hear, is how much of a creative experience it was, because you just have so many out there, you know, technical creative minds whose idea of fun is just making something spontaneously on a Saturday night. So I was exposed to a lot of different maker type people, exposed to a lot of different musicians, people from all different walks of life. And it really kind of inspired me to try everything that interests me. So I was able to join a professional dance troupe. I was able to join the men's gymnastics team. I started doing stunt work in films. So it was really a great time of creative stimulation, actually.
I feel like we got to back up a little bit before MIT So what's the balance between Minnesota and Tokyo as far as like your childhood? Is it mostly in Minnesota, mostly in Tokyo? Are you going to school in one place or the other, more or less?
It was about 50-50. I would say, you know, before I was five, I lived in Minnesota, but then between five and when I left for university, it was about 6 years in Japan. So a lot of the formative years were actually in Japan, both as a young child, but also as a teenager. It was through IBM. My father was an engineer at IBM. He has a Japanese last name, and so he seemed to be the logical choice when they were starting to do a lot of different international assignments. And so they said, you have a Japanese last name. Why don't you go to Tokyo? So I benefited from that, and I was able to spend 6 years of my childhood in Tokyo.
And then did you move back to the U.S. for any part of high school after that, or just for college you came back to the U.S.?
I was there for the last couple of years of high school and then college.
So I myself am an immigrant to the U.S., but I came when I was like two. So I don't really have memories of living abroad, but definitely struggled a little bit with like the identity issue of, am I American or am I something else? Did you feel like as a kid, like you were American or like more like you were Japanese because you were growing up in that culture? Or where did you feel like you belonged to as a kid?
I sort of belonged to whichever place I wasn't in, I think. And a big part of that is just because of the environment that you're in. So when I'm in the US or when I'm in Europe, a lot of people will typically see me as Asian. And so I'll feel like, oh, well, maybe I should be in Asia. But then when I'm in Japan, people say, no, there's no way you're half Japanese. I don't see it at all. And so then, of course, I'm feeling more Western. So it's sort of the opposite of wherever I am is kind of where I feel more at home.
Nice. One thing also about MIT, coming back to that for a moment, is it seems to get like more jugglers than any other college that I know about, particularly like high level jugglers. I know it's a random question, but was that the case at all when you were there?
Yes, Absolutely, especially if you are in mathematics, there's a high probability that you're also a juggler on the side. Something about the combinations and the different notations that are involved in juggling that seems to stimulate a lot of mathematical minded folks. So yeah, there were a ton of jugglers all over the place. And on top of that, you also have fantastic marble floors, which is very good for rebound juggling. So they had really good raw materials at their fingertips.
What style of dance were you exploring when you were at MIT?
The director and the founder of the dance company that I worked with, it was a dance company called Snappy Dance. She had actually trained with the Palabolas dance group, took a lot of inspiration from them. So it was very structural, movement-based stuff with a lot of balances, a lot of acrobatics. They were actually very interested in working with me because I didn't have the modern dancer vocabulary. I was basically pulling all from my martial arts background, my gymnastics background, and my stunt background, and really trying to learn as much as I possibly could about the modern dance vocabulary. But it was a really fun time where it's kind of nice when you're hired for something you're not experienced in, because it gives you full rein to kind of explore and adapt and try and learn as much as possible about something new. They kept telling me, don't worry about it, don't worry about the modern dance piece. But my point of view was that, you know, how often do you get to train with professional dancers and benefit from it? And it just happened to coincide with the timing when I learned that there is such a thing as professional circus schools in North America. And they were super helpful in helping me to frame my training and the creation of my audition piece for the Connaissance de Cirque in Montreal. So it ended up being quite a nice timing of everything kind of coming together at the right moment in my life.
When does the circus enter your life? Like, were you seeing shows in school or in college that made you go like, oh, I should do that instead of stunt work or something else similar?
Well, when I was young, I was involved in physical theater, and the style that I was most inspired by was the physical theater of Jacques Lecoq. And I grew up in Minnesota for this part of my life. This was at the tail end of my high school career, and there was a really famous Jacques Lecoq theater in Minneapolis. And the small theater school that I worked with had a very close relationship with them. So we got to take all these master classes with these French physical acting masters, which was just, again, one of these weird things that happens in life. Like, wow, how did I get to benefit from this? And in one of those trainings, they just showed us Saltimbanco. It must have been 94, 95, something like this. They showed us the PBS video of Saltimbanco. And I was just really in awe of it, because at the time I was a musician, I was an actor, but I was really interested in acrobatics. And there was just nothing like that anywhere else. And so when I saw that all on this screen, I said, wow, that's really kind of the amalgamation of everything that I'd really like to be able to do in my life. I kind of had this joking goal, like, oh, wow, I really want to join the circus, but never took it seriously until in 2000, I met an incoming freshman at MIT who had just finished a session at the San Francisco Circus School. And she was telling me about it, and I, what is a circus school? You know, what is that? What does that look like? What are the people like? And I think I talked to her for about 24 hours straight about what her experience was at circus school. And she said, yeah, and there's like one of the best in the world is in Montreal. And I was like, Montreal, what's that? Where's that? And then I think for the next year, it became sort of my number one priority in life was to get ready to do the Montreal Circus School audition. And then she was Tanya Burka, by the way. I'm not sure.
Whoa. Yeah. Sure. We know Tanya.
Yes, we do. From Joe Pinzon.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, Joe was at Connaissance de Cirque the same time I was. Tanya came in as a freshman at MIT when I was a senior at MIT, and she's actually the person who made me realize that this maybe wasn't a pipe dream, but this may have actually been a viable career opportunity going forward.
Were your parents, how did they react? Because, you know, I feel like having a son who goes to MIT and is kind of like a quote unquote dream for some parents, and then you know, to be like, I'm actually going to go now to circus school. How did that sit with your parents?
Well, they were super confused by that, but they also saw it coming because MIT was already a bit of a negotiation because I really wanted to go into the arts directly from high school. But my parents said, you really do need to finish your college education. But once you're done with the college education, we won't be financially supporting you anymore. You're going to be completely free, so you can do whatever you want. And I'm sure that in the back of their mind, they thought that going through MIT, I would be, you know, plugged in immediately to a job. And I was working at a NASA lab doing solar wind research. But the call of performing arts really was stronger than ever. And I really took that opportunity to make that switch and take an all or nothing bet on circus education. My logic was, if I don't get in, that's fine, and I can go do biology or I can go do astrophysics. But if I do get in, I mean, this is the right time in my life at 21, 22 years old. I'm never going to be in better physical condition. I'm never going to have less connections to things in my life. So this would be the time to go all in on circus. And then I got the yes from the school. And so that took me there. And initially, I wasn't planning on doing my entire life's work in circus. I was expecting to do 3 years of the program and then maybe work for a couple of years and then go to grad school in something more MIT-like. But it didn't work out that way. And so here I am 16 years later, still in this crazy industry.
What did you specialize in at ENC?
I specialized in hand balancing. And my minor was in basically physical comedy, the same stuff that I had done when I was younger. So there was a clown who had done a lot of work as a child in traditional circus. He was in a two clown partnership. He was really coming from the super traditional circus world, and he was really fascinated by everything that was theatrical and physical theater, mime, and, you know, sort of this more subtle physical gestural vocabulary. And I was just fascinated with anything that had to do with circus in Europe and the roots of circus. Anything that was, you know, the further east in Europe it was, the older it was in circus history, the more fascinating it was to me. And so we really had a very respectful partnership where he kind of taught me everything he knew about the traditional circus comedy and the traditional circus culture. And I taught him everything I knew about this physical theater vocabulary.
Nice. And how was it after you graduated? I know when we interviewed Joe Pinzon for this show a couple of years ago, he talked about facing what he felt like was a lot of anti-Asian casting, as maybe a nice way to say it. But was it easy for you to find work afterwards? Was it a challenge? What was that like?
Well, compared to film, it was not as much of a challenge. You know, I've played tons of, you know, martial arts students and Chinese delivery boys in my film career. That's pretty much all that's on my reel. And like martial arts stunts and things like that, Ninja Number 3. But the first project I did was actually in Japan. And, but, you know, they were... It was kind of reverse of what Joe talks about, is that Japan was very much looking for foreign people to be in their show. So I looked foreign enough, I guess, to Japanese eyes to be able to sneak in. But I can definitely sympathize with Joe, who's done, I think, a lot more of his work in North America and in Europe compared to me, who's done most of his work as a performer in Asia. I can sympathize with that because just going to shows here, I see that as an Asian looking performer, there are certain roles, certain stereotypes, certain archetypes that you're kind of expected to fit into. And I didn't really have that pressure when I was at the core of my professional career. I really had freedom to kind of do anything that I wanted. I could imagine it would be super frustrating to be in a situation like that. And I think it's something that's slowly evolving, but I haven't personally experienced that just because of where I had most of my performing career take place.
I wonder if it's also different being an aerialist versus more of a ground strength act, if that has anything to do with it as well. I don't know.
I think that has... I think that that has a big part of it as well. I mean, there's conceptions of masculinity, there's conceptions of beauty, conceptions of attractiveness. It was also super easy for me because I had done many years of martial arts. I mean, the vocabulary just kind of crept into my number, all of the ground choreographies that I did. And that martial arts actually ended up being a major touch point that I had in common, whether I was in India working with Kathakali artists, or whether I was working with Wushu artists in Taiwan, or whether I was working with any other variety of Taekwondo artists in Korea, for example. It was kind of a common physical vocabulary that we could use at the base of various shows or various choreographies that we had to pull together. So I definitely felt like it was pretty easy for me to resonate with certain aspects of the culture in the multiple Asian countries where I've had the opportunity to work. I'm not sure how I would have done that in France or Germany or England, for example.
So later on, you transitioned to going back to school to get an MBA after your performing career. I mean, I have two sort of questions to that. One is, why an MBA? Why go in that direction? And two, sort of jumping off of that. So Lindsay and I met doing a master's program, and I always felt my whole life, whether that was my undergrad degree or grad degree, that saying like, oh yeah, I work in circus or I'm interested in circus was like a hack to get like professors' attention, because nobody in those situations would ever say that kind of thing, because there's so few people coming up through it. And it ended up, I think, piquing people's interests more than the average. So I'm wondering, can you speak to why you decided to go back to school and what that experience was like transitioning temporarily out of the circus world and into this very like business oriented space?
Well, I get a lot of people in the arts domain and other domains who are asking me, you know, oh, should I look at an MBA? And my answer always is, if there's absolutely no other way to get the knowledge or the network that you're looking for, then yes, you probably want to look at it at an MBA. But if you don't feel that kind of urgency and that need, I would say it's probably a waste of your time, and you would probably be much better served trying to, you know, seek out the projects that you want to do, or seek out the people who are doing the projects that you want to do. In my case, I really, really intensely worked between 2005 and 2008 to start my business in Asia. And that business was basically trying to first direct, but then realizing that if I wanted to direct the shows I wanted to do, I would have to be a producer. And then I realized, well, if I wanted to be a producer, I really needed to be an entrepreneur to be able to find the resources to actually make these shows happen. And I somehow managed to have success. I think it had a big part to do with where I was and when I was in Asia. It was just a time where Cirque du Soleil was just kind of breaking out and in Asia and being super successful in Asia. A lot of people wanted to bring Cirque du Soleil-like things, and there was a ton of money because it was just before this 2009 economic crisis. So it was just the right time and the right place to be doing projects like this. I wish I could say it was all me, but I'm wise enough now to know that it definitely was not all me. So I think that the key moment for me was after I'd finished, it was in August or September of 2008. I mean, it must have been literally weeks before the Lehman Brothers collapse. And I had just done three projects that I would have dreamt of doing 3 years before. Like they were bigger projects with more people, with more freedom. Like they were the kind of projects I had dreamed about 3 years before. And I was just kind of facing this weird existential depression of like realizing that if I continue to do projects like those for the rest of my life, I would be definitely satisfied. I would be busy, but I would definitely not be happy. Like they weren't the kind of projects that I was kind of cursed by getting what I had dreamt of without really asking myself why I wanted to do those projects. And I felt that I achieved this mountain, and I got up to the top of the mountain and looked around, and I was like, why did I choose this mountain when there's so many other great mountains to be looking at? I also had some feedback from some of my clients and partners that said, you're never going to do bigger projects than these, because we trust you as an artist and we trust you as a creator, but we don't trust you as a person who can handle investments. We don't trust you. You're just a risky guy because you're just an artist. which they didn't mean to be derogatory. They just meant to say that my skill set did not include a skill set that would make investors feel comfortable giving me significant budgets. And it was this reflection that made me really consider the MBA as a path. And the more I researched it, the more I realized that there were a lot of skills there that I needed to know. I knew that there were a lot of questions I had about how to do what I was doing in the entertainment world sustainably, both for personal reasons, but also artistically sustainable, also from a financially and business sustainable model. And I just knew that I wasn't the only artist who was asking these type of questions. So I applied in 2008. Like, I think I took the exam on the week that Lehman Brothers collapsed, got in, but simultaneously was offered the job of artistic director for touring shows at Cirque du Soleil, like in just one of those weird synchronous events that happen in your life. And I had to make the choice. So I actually ended up deferring my admission to Wharton in order to accept the position of artistic director. And then I actually got a promotion and went into a different show. And so I had to actually defer it for a second year. But I entered finally in 2011 for a class of 2013. The reason why I decided to stop deferring and actually bite the bullet and go do this education is because Cirque du Soleil was the first large organization I'd ever worked for. It was the first large arts organization I'd ever worked for. And I realized that at every level in the organization, there are people who are asking themselves the same kind of questions that I was asking myself as a solo entrepreneur in arts in Asia. And I realized that there was a lot of value to be found by pursuing the answer to these business questions in the neutral MBA space rather than, you know, sort of the passion-focused industry of arts that I was in. It was helpful to step into the MBA and say, let me just learn it abstractly, and then let me figure out how to apply it to something that I love, rather than forcing myself to try and answer two questions at once in the arts world.
You know, as Josh mentioned, we met at grad school, but we went to Columbia, and we were in the producing program at Columbia in the art school, but we utilized a lot of the business classes that we could sign up for and take. And I think that most of the knowledge, the practical knowledge we gained was from actually the business classes. I mean, how to do contracts and spreadsheets and budgets and all that we of course learned, but really just like the mindset of how to form a business, how to be an entrepreneur was not taught at the arts mm-hmm. school, but really the business school. But as you were talking, I was just thinking about how the difference between commercial ventures and nonprofit. And I think the reason we both went to school, and it sounds like you too, is because we were kind of always more commercial based focused. Mm-hmm. And in a nonprofit, it's a little bit easier to be the artist and start your own company, because then you get donations for people who want to support you as an artist versus mm-hmm. commercial ventures. It's like, well, how are you going to handle this money? Mm-hmm. And I didn't really think about that.
No, I think that's valid. I mean, if you were to ask me what I do now, like 45% of my time is trying to educate business people about arts, and 45% of my time is trying to educate arts people about business. And then 10% of my time is actually making the projects that those conversations spark happen. It's not the division of labor that I want to have, but it's the division of labor that works. Like, it takes 90% of effort to get the business people to stop being scared of artists and to get the artists to stop being scared of the business. In the work that I do with artists, I find that it's relatively easy to get artists with a commercial focus to understand the value of the business principles that I can bring to the table. When I'm dealing with people who are working in more nonprofit or more socially focused initiatives, it's much harder to get them to understand the value of some of these business principles. But in my experience, they actually can benefit from those business principles much more simply by framing their project a little bit differently, simply about thinking about what sustainability means for them, even thinking about what success means for them, what success means for them as a project. I mean, these are core business principles that have absolutely nothing to do with money, but they do have a lot to do with how you approach a given project. So I do think that both nonprofit and for-profit can benefit from it, but it takes a lot more translation to be able to communicate these business principles to people who are coming from the more nonprofit end of the sector.
Before we move off of the master's degree topic, one more question on that. When I was deciding whether or not I should go to grad school, I was working at Spiegelworld and I was very close to not going. And Ross Mollison, who runs Spiegelworld, basically said to me, if you want to raise money for your own shows, like rich investors are going to like seeing a master's degree from a fancy school on there. And that will make a big difference to raising money. But as far as like working for Spiegelworld or working for Cirque du Soleil, like nobody cares. It's really about that side of the business. And I'm wondering, do you feel like when you're raising money or talking to people from that business side, like they, like it's really now you know things that you didn't know before and it's your personality and new knowledge that's the change? Or is it the fact that you have this degree from a nice school and all of a sudden, okay, like you have that stamp, so now you're trusted?
It's both, and but it's really in the eye of the beholder. So for someone who really doesn't know whether I'm saying something with value or not, they like to see Wharton MBA and MBA and MIT undergraduate. Like they just like to say, like, I don't know if it's right or not, but it's the right educational pedigree. For the people who really know what I'm talking about, whether it's on the business side or it's the production side or it's the creative side or it's the operational side, it's much more the skills that I learned, the material that I learned in the MBA class. And the reason why is because what I know about leadership, what I know about economics, what I know about communication, what I know about negotiation, what I know about managing teams, unifying teams, getting people to buy in, influencing people, persuading people, dealing with conflict, all of that came from the business school world. I mean, we all know that conflict is part of the creative process. It's a super important motivator of the creative process. It's something that we lean into when we're in the studio and it creates these amazing gems. But aside from knowing it's necessary, I think it's very rare that artists stop and say, are we managing this conflict in the most effective way possible? And these are the kind of questions that the MBA actually helped me answer for myself. So like I said, if they don't know what I'm talking about, they liked having the branding of the different schools that I've been to. If they do know what I'm talking about, I personally know I would not be as effective at communicating what I want to communicate to them if I hadn't been through the MBA experience.
Except if it's artistic, they're like, oh, cool, you went to ENC. Great. Who cares about Warren and MIT? Sweet. You went to
ENC. it doesn't hurt. That's for sure. I mean, branding is important, but it's both sides. Just the branding alone wouldn't have made it worth it. That's for sure.
So I saw on your LinkedIn, you did then, after business school, have a little bit of the traditional stint at a what's the type of firm they call them? Like a consulting firm, basically. What did you say?
I think they call it a white shoe firm, if I'm not mistaken.
A white shoe firm.
Back in the 50s, I guess they had nice white dress shoes. I'm not sure.
Did that just additionally reinforce, like, okay, I'm getting out of the regular business world and staying in the circus world? And then tangentially off of that, after doing consulting and going to grad school, was there some other path? You've climbed this other mountain that you said. Did you now have sights on something else?
So the time that I spent as a McKinsey consultant was one of the most exciting times I've ever had in my life to serve these major international organizations, to serve different governments around the world. It was just a fascinating glimpse behind the curtain. And it was also a way for me to apply practically the skills I'd learned theoretically at the MBA, and also to gain a bit of self-confidence. Like when you're sitting there across the table from a CEO of a major corporation and you're explaining to him or her a new way to look at some aspect of their business that had been causing them a lot of problems in the past, you kind of stop thinking about yourself as an imposter. You kind of stop thinking of yourself as just an artist. You start realizing that you're someone who can come to pretty much any situation and just through their own experience, through their own education, their own knowledge, their own skills, actually help help people solve problems. And that's what I think that was all about. I would have been more than happy to continue doing that all the way through to the partner level if the opportunity to rejoin Cirque du Soleil hadn't come up in February of 2016. And that's because I always knew that after getting as far as I could in McKinsey, basically once McKinsey was no longer fun for me, I knew I was going to be going back to live entertainment and to the arts. But then this once in a lifetime opportunity of being able to support the executive team of Cirque du Soleil directly came up, and it was a once in a lifetime shot. I did try saying, well, what if I, you know, can I do one more year here at McKinsey? They're like, you're kind of missing everything if you come 1 year later. So it was kind of a now or never sort of situation. So I packed everything up and moved back to Montreal in February of 2016.
So it seems like the you have like the pre and post TPG Cirque du Soleil experience. I'm wondering if you're comfortable speaking to like any differences you noticed in just how the company was run before and afterwards.
Well, you have even more. You have pre-TPG, TPG, post-TPG, right?
Yeah, there's been a lot of phases. I mean, my time at the company started in 2009 and continued until 2019. Well, let's say beginning of 2019. So I have almost a 10-year span of that company. There definitely were a ton of different phases. And it was so complicated because it's easy to divide it as saying, oh, well, these were the Guy years and these were the TPG years. But in reality, you know, large companies are run by such a constellation of people that it was a really how could I say it? Every week, every month, the chemistry changed because new people were coming in, some people were leaving. I would say that I mean, there's no question that Guy Laliberté came from the world of live entertainment. And what I know from having worked with a lot of other owner founders of many other different circus companies all around the world is he really approached the management of Cirque du Soleil and the creative decisions from an owner, manager, and as a former artist, as someone who was really focused on live entertainment. It's just... There's so much in common with the way he ran that company and how I see people running companies here in Europe that have been in the families for, in some cases, you know, 8, 9, 10 generations. So that's one thing I can definitely say is he definitely ran the organization in that way. TPG, they do have a broad portfolio of different companies that they operated, but I would say that Cirque du Soleil was probably the most complex example of an entertainment company that they had in their portfolio. I mean, it's on the one hand, what could be harder? It's a circus company. But then if you overlay on top of that the operational complexity of having three major business lines, and that's just the three major ones. There were many more business lines at that time. But just looking at, you have your resident shows, and then you have your big top shows, and you have your arena shows, each one of them requiring completely different operational know-how, completely different technical know-how, completely different production know-how, and then trying to manage that complicated dance of creating content for one format that has to be transitioned into another. And then when you take into account all of the counterintuitive aspects of live entertainment, and that's a lot of things. It just takes a really long learning curve if you haven't been raised in that. So I think what I can say is that Guy definitely managed it as an artist, owner, operator. And TPG was definitely coming in with a super complicated, super ambitious asset in their portfolio that they wanted to be managing.
One thing Josh and I have talked about with ourselves and with others is this idea of leadership and what happens to a company, profit or nonprofit, when that founding visionary person who has very, very strong direction for the company artistically, what happens when they are removed or leave or are adjacent to the company? How does everyone continue forward without that visionary? Do you need to replace that visionary with a new one? Do you continue on through what you think that is. And we just seen a lot of companies struggling with this, like, moment of change of when the leader is gone,
particularly circus companies. Like, yeah. I would include, aside from Cirque and that, like Big Apple Circus is another example of that. I mean, you mentioned these 10th generation circus companies, so they're managing that problem by keeping it within the family. But yeah, can you speak to that at all?
Sure. I mean, it's a challenge for every industry. I took a course at business school about family enterprise, simply because I wanted to go deeper into that, because I think that traditionally circuses tended to be run by families. Some got much larger and some ended up becoming more professionalized. But I still think that the dynamic beneath it all really had a lot in common with these family enterprises, these family businesses. And I think that you can definitely have success passing the torch from one generation of leadership to the other, but it has to be a huge priority for everyone involved. And you have to accept that there's going to be almost nothing else happening except getting that succession plan in place. I think a good example of success was the Walt Disney Company. Just after the passing of Walt, I think they really managed the right balance of succession planning. They had a couple of aspects to it. I mean, they had some of this, you know, mythology of, you know, passing the royal scepter from one brother to the other. So there was a little bit of that kind of King Arthur, like, you know, legend continuing. But I think they'd also done a lot in terms of making sure that all of the different divisions understood what was going to be happening as this plan was executed. I think that what Disney had was they had an enormously broad base and diversity of creative assets that they were managing, everything from their theme parks to their movies to, you know, all aspects of that entire empire, the television that they had. And so they had the breadth to be able to have people who were really focusing on the questions of the succession plan. I think that most circus companies are so busy working on the projects that they're currently keeping alive and the next project that they want to bring to life, that succession can almost never be the focus of every single person in that company. So I think, again, it's just coming down. I would say that 90% of the non-experts that I talk to about the circus industry are completely blown away by how complicated and counterintuitive every aspect of the industry is. And if you're in it and you know it, you know, the fish doesn't know it's wet. The fish doesn't know that it's dealing with all of this complexity. And circus artists and circus producers, you don't realize all of the different balls that they have up in the air. But from an outsider, it looks absolutely mad. And I think that one of the symptoms of that madness is that no one's ever taking the time to just stop and say, how are we going to carry this on to the next generation of leadership? There are obviously some families that have managed to do it, typically passing from one generation to the other, father to son, father to daughter. And I'm seeing it happen right now. There's kind of a revolution in generations that's happening here in Europe, with some of the younger generations really for the first time coming to the forefront of some of the shows that are being created. But again, they have the advantage of taking 5 years, 10 years to do these transitions, where in the world of large businesses, these things have to happen sometimes in 2 years. And it's tough to get everybody to see the pretender to the throne as a credible personality when they've only been working with this person in this capacity for 2 years or less.
One thing that you've mentioned a couple of times in different ways that I want to bring up is this sort of, one of the things that I think is counterintuitive about circus is the role of the producer and the role of the director. And one thing you said earlier was like, if I want to make shows that are in my mind and direct them, well, then I need to produce them. And then I need to know the entrepreneurial skills to make that happen. And I feel like in plays or theater, for example, you have the playwright and the director is working with that material, and the role of the producer is very specific. In the movie business, again, there's a writer, there's a director, there's a producer with very different roles. But I think in circus, they're much blurrier. And often the producer is also the director and is also the entrepreneur.
And sometimes the writer.
And so, yeah, and often the writer, right? If it's your idea. Going back to, of course, somebody we spoke about a few times, Joe Pinzon, we could use his show, for example. He wrote it, directed it, produced it, took it to Europe to promote it. So do you think that's a good model or bad model? I guess is the broad question. Like, should we be looking to other industries and being like, that's a more better structured way to do it, or this more unusual, nebulous way is good?
I think that you... to someone who's interested in how to do things better, I would suggest to that person to go and study everything you can about all of the different models that work. And then through your own personal network, go and find every example of models that should have worked but didn't, and then see if you can identify what the critical flaw was in that particular model. I think that Broadway is the most transparent, accessible, historical, easy to study model that's out there. You can just find so much information, and it's a great reference for everyone to use. And in the work that I do, especially when I'm trying to help business people understand the world of live entertainment in general and circus in particular, I always start with Broadway. And then what I'm able to do is I'm able to say, do you understand everything about Broadway? Do you understand everything about the investment that's required, about the creative process, about the production process, about the investment process, about how that money is recouped, how the management is put in place, about all of the legal issues that come into play? And do you understand what success looks like and what disaster looks like? All of these aspects. Do you understand all of this? Okay, great. Now I'm going to teach you about the circus world by explaining what's different from the Broadway model. And if they're particularly philosophical, I can also explain part of the reason behind it and how very different the Broadway model is from the circus model. For example, in Broadway, again, I love Broadway, but I wouldn't call myself a super fan. But my understanding is that there's many different layers that need to be there in order for even the average audience to really appreciate it, because there's so much there. Like, you really need to have the right book. You really need to have the right libretto. You really need to have the right artist. Everybody has to be a triple threat. Like, everything has to just gel together perfectly. Now, what I'm about to say, I know, is, especially in the world of contemporary circus, can be potentially, contentious, but at the end of the day, from having been artistic director at Cirque du Soleil, having worked on many different circus projects with other companies around the world, my impression is that as long as the human performers in your circus production deliver top-notch performances and really do their job as artists to connect with the audience and inspire emotions in the audience, you can get away with a lot. If the music isn't great, if the costumes weren't perfect, if the lighting wasn't amazing, if you don't have perfect augmented reality glasses syncing with everything, like, at the end of the day, if you really just have the most amazing 10 artists who connect with the artists, your average audience, the audience of grandmothers and little kids, is going to walk away feeling like, wow, that was just so wonderful to see all those people right there. Whereas I'm not sure the same is true for Broadway. So I don't envy how complicated the creative and the production and the financial ecosystem of Broadway is. But I can definitely appreciate why it's set up the way that it is. In my experience, in the work that I've done when I go and I study the circus industry all around the world, the most successful circuses, and by successful, my definition is maybe different than most people. Is for me, a successful circus company is a company that is able to sustainably operate for many years in a row, and in doing so, create multiple opportunities for circus professionals to make their living. So for me, that's the definition of a successful circus company. And the most successful circus companies are always putting the priority on getting the best performances on stage, and the best performances done by the best performers on stage. And I think that any company that has any circus company that puts that as their North Star is probably going to be destined for success, assuming they have the infrastructure in place to actually pull all of that talent globally onto their stage. So that for me is the main reason for why the Broadway model looks so different from the circus model. The circus model at its best is just saying, let's find the best performers in the world and get them onto one stage for one season. Whereas Broadway is saying, we need the absolute best scriptwriter, we need the absolute best songwriters, we need the absolute best singers, et cetera, et cetera. We need to pull them all together and make this show. And we have to recognize that 50% of the shows don't even last 1 year in Broadway.
No.
For making so the Broadway model actually has a lot more risk. And so because of that, there has to be a lot more mechanisms in place to help people manage and mitigate that risk.
One more nuance too, that I always had challenges with when I was working prior to meeting Josh in Broadway, was that for commercial producers, was that the vision of the producer was one thing. And then mm-hmm. if that producer hires a writer to write their vision, that writer's vision is something different. And then if you hire a librettist or a lyricist composer team, they're then having their own vision. And it's like, it's all these different visions trying to work towards one. And unless you have this writer, which is why I think like Hamilton worked so well, because you have Lin-Manuel Miranda basically essentially doing what the circus entrepreneur does of thinking of the idea, writing it and starring in it. And slightly producing it. It was like his vision leading the show versus trying to conglomerate all these different ideas. And in a way, that's why circus, I think, can at least work towards one goal of like, okay, we're all these circus artists, we're doing this show, this is the theme, this is what we're doing. And you get your own individuality in that show. You're not trying to get everyone to continually just follow one idea. Oh, it was a nightmare, actually, that project that I'm thinking about. But yeah, I think that's what I always was like when I came into circus, like that's really special about circus. That is so nice and freeing when you take out the really structured roles of Broadway.
Well, I love that you mentioned that because I think that that's a really key piece is that at the end of the day, when the snowstorm comes, regardless of whether you're the star aerialist, regardless of whether you're the band leader, regardless whether you're the welder on the tent, everybody is a snow shoveler at that point in circus. And it's why I think a lot of circus people are suspicious of hierarchy. They're suspicious of job titles. All that really matters in my experience in the circus world is, I don't care who you are. I don't care where you came from. I don't care what your job title is. What are you actually doing? What do I observe? And how mindful are you about the impact that your actions have on the rest of the people involved on this production, on this show, right? I mean, are you the person who comes in and double parks their caravan and makes it impossible for other people to get in when they're the last ones to get in, into the parking area? Or are you the kind of person who's like, you know, actually thinking about everything else that's going to come forward? And this is the complexity that is so counterintuitive in circus, because everyone thinks, I mean, it's just, what do you need? You know, lions and tigers and aerialists, but every single aspect in a circus show affects every other aspect of the circus show. We know this intuitively, but before I had gone through my MBA program, I wasn't able to communicate it effectively. And to be honest, even after my MBA time, it was still very challenging to communicate it. Why, for example, is it much less expensive to go from one circus show touring to two circus shows touring, but why do you lose that advantage of scale as you start getting to 5 to 6 to 7 different shows? Why does it all of a sudden start getting more expensive to add additional shows to your portfolio? If I look globally, there are very few circus companies or variety companies, in fact, I can't think of any right now, that have managed to do more than 6 or 7 shows per business unit. Like Cirque du Soleil is managing 6 or 7 resident shows, 6 or 7 big top shows, 6 or 7 arena shows. If you look at Palazzo in Germany, they have 6 or 7 shows that they're running. There's something about 6 or 7 where it just becomes too complicated to add an 8th, where people are like, we're good at 6 or 7, right? But economically, that doesn't make sense. A business-minded person, a bank, is like, there has to be enormous economies of scale, because you still just have one marketing department. You still just have one ticketing department. You still just have one production department. Why aren't we doing 20, 30, 40 of these? And it takes more than just economic skills, it takes a little bit of an intuition of having spent a lifetime in this art to be able to answer those questions, why you can't just add a name.
Yeah, so our last guest as of recording this was Tom Schumacher, who runs Disney Theatrical Group.
I was just looking at that just before we did this. I'm like, wow, okay, you have Schumacher and now me. Wow.
But one thing, we asked him that question of like, why is it that there's like 10 Lion Kings going around the world, but only one O in Las mm-hmm. Vegas? And like, which business model makes more sense under what circumstances, essentially? And one thing he even spoke about was having too many Disney shows on Broadway that are all, for lack of a better word, like the pop animation things people are familiar with, start to cannibalize one another. So once he had Frozen, Aladdin, Lion King all going, then he had to focus on things like Peter and the Starcatcher or stuff that's more artsy, because that
Revival of Aida.
Revival of Aida, because they'd already taken up all of their market on Broadway, essentially. But just asking a question back to how you were saying, like, once you have five or six units, do you mean like once you have five or six different arena shows, or five or six of the same show going on in an arena?
Arena shows, different arena shows.
And do you think that like there's a reason why circuses shouldn't have six Salty and Bonkos going on at the same time, the way there are six Lion Kings going on? Obviously, with like going back to the differences with Lion King, you can have identical costumes, singers who sound very, very similar. And you have six Salty and Bonkos, you might not be able to find six Russian swing troops that can all do the same technical level.
For me, it comes down to the way a Broadway performer trains and prepares themselves for a career on Broadway versus the way a circus performer trains and prepares himself for a career in the circus. At some point when you're coming up in the Broadway world, my understanding is that you are expected to be, quote unquote, a tool of the creative team. Like you are there to express the song that they've written, to communicate the line, to deliver the lines that they have written. And if you can't do it, there's 20 people behind you who will do it, as well or better than you.
And without complaining.
Without complaining, without being difficult. But it's something that you accept about it, because there are definitely a lot more hopeful Broadway performers in the world than there are circus performers, because there's other advantages to that where you do have enormous mobility. You are able to get a job in theoretically any Broadway show in New York or in West End or in Hamburg or in Australia. Like, you have that kind of safety net of many more shows that you've prepared for. The challenge with Saltimbanco, in the Saltimbanco example, is that Saltimbanco was created as a special alchemy of the creative team of Debbie Brown, of Dragon, of Michel Crête, of everybody involved in that show, with those 60 to 70 performers that were there. Not those disciplines, right? Not those choreographies, not those acts, but those personalities. A really interesting alchemy that happened, and then that became Saltimbanco. When one of those artists leaves, is it possible to train someone up to replace that person? Absolutely, and they did it with great success. But when you start talking about replicating and having different casts of that, the problem is the following. Because of the way the show was created with, let's say, 60 artists, those 60 artists in that show were the world's 60 best artists for that show, because it was created for them and forged with those personalities and those stage presences right there. If you were to duplicate that cast, the best you could possibly do would be to have the second best 60. And so all of a sudden you have a Saltimbanco prime and you have a Saltimbanco copy. And I mean, you could do things of saying, well, okay, I'm going to take 30 of one cast, 30 of the other, so that I have a similar quality between the two. But at the end of the day, my belief is that audiences are pretty smart at things that they can't really articulate or observe consciously. Audiences really know if they're getting the best or not. And I think that in Broadway, you might very well be able to have 100 people who can deliver the best Broadway quality of a given role. But I think that when you're looking in the world of circus, I really think that it's much fewer people who can deliver that kind of experience. And I think that audiences will feel it. They know when they're seeing something that's cookie cutter versus if they're seeing something that's one of a kind, custom made, artisanal performance experience. And I think that's why circus is much harder to have duplicate cast, aside from the production complexity, the investment complexity, and all these different things. But I think at the base, that's the real reason why it's very difficult to replicate circus shows.
That's so true. I also was just thinking about creating a show around a cast of people, and you have that like magic that is indescribable of just like the personalities that you get in that room, and then it's never quite the same. It's like Wicked. It's like, if it wasn't Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth, would everyone have loved that show as much? I don't know, you know, who knows? But at least they can replicate it, because I guess at this point it's the music that everyone fell in love with. So I guess it's like that one thing.
That's true, because there are certain aspects to the show, like the soundtrack of a Broadway show will roughly be the same as it goes forward, because it does exist as a score. But if you're looking at, there's no such thing as a score or a choreography of, let's take a classical example of like, if we use Kidang, we could use Tissue as an example. We could use Hand Balancing as an example. We could use the Banquine as an example. Like, there's no notation. There are videos that exist, but every artist, every performer who comes in, Atanya actually played the role of the Tissues for a while when she was on that show. They bring some aspect of themselves. There's something that changes. They're not copying exactly what that is. They're feeling something that's different, and it's encouraged. But what that means is that the entire artistic team who are operating that show, who are responsible for casting the artist, and then who are responsible for integrating that artist into a Cirque du Soleil show, they have a very, and I felt that when I was artistic director on these shows, is what are we trying to do? Are we trying to find the artist who can exactly copy mechanically this choreography as closely as possible? Or are we looking for someone who will come in and through their presence achieve through their performance the same effect that the artist that they're replacing was able to achieve for that audience? Two very, very different approaches to handling artist replacements. And if you take into account that as artistic director, I had a boss, and which version I wanted to do would depend a lot on my boss's appreciation and ability to communicate why that decision was correct to their boss and their boss's boss, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's very easy to be able to say, this was the first artist, this was the second artist, they're doing everything exactly the same. We have successfully integrated this artist. Versus, no, watch the audience and look at the audience in the eyes while they're watching this. And the journey, the emotional journey that the audience is experiencing as they're watching this act is the same journey. Even though the artist is doing something completely different, this is actually a better replacement. So this is another challenge. It's no longer, did we hit the, I don't want to belittle Broadway, saying it's just hitting the right notes and saying the right lines.
Well, but it is.
Well, to some degree, that's kind of how your job is defined.
Yeah.
Right? Like, hit your mark.
Did she hit that last note?
Exactly. So you can measure that. It's much tougher, I find, in the world of circus, because you're dealing with people who are so much, in the business world, we say less fungible. They're not replaceable by the 20 people who are lined up outside. Like, there's a lot more one of a kind talent in our industry, which is what makes it so special.
Yeah, it's funny using the word non-fungible with circus artists, because it's such a business term, but it is like the most true thing ever. Before we start wrapping up, I wanted to just ask you how COVID has been for you. What was going on like immediately before COVID,
and why you're in Belgium?
Why you moved to Germany, Berlin, you said.
Oh, Berlin.
Berlin. Why you moved to Berlin, and how it's been under lockdown, and you know how you've been, just handling this last year.
I'm getting used to it. now I know how to manage my business under COVID 12 months after the fact. It coincided with me starting a family, so it actually couldn't have been better timing, because we were already planning to reduce our activities by about 50% to just focus on having a little one at home.
How old is your baby?
10 months this week.
Oh, we have an 8-month-old.
Nice. No, it's been, to be honest, part of what my girlfriend and I are doing right now, looking at COVID, is saying, well, what aspects of this COVID year do we want to maintain going forward? Because some parts of it have been fantastic for us, not only personally and from a family perspective, but also from a business perspective. Like, Of course, all business activity stopped in March, April, May, like it did for everyone else in this industry. But the interesting realization over the last 12 months is like 80% of those projects, I'm so glad that they stopped. Like, it was such a waste of time. And then all of a sudden, the space that that creates for the 20% of the projects that we were glad to continue working on have given us the time to approach them in the right way and to ask the right questions, to do what we talked about at the beginning of the call, like frame it correctly, to set up the right constraints, to set up the right objectives, to build the team around it, get everybody excited about it. I think that the most important thing that we did right when COVID came around is we gave ourselves time to breathe, and we said, how are we going to be prioritizing opportunities that come up, both opportunities that come up, but also opportunities that we may need to go and chase in this current environment. And I think that the first rule that we had was we're not going to focus on any projects that come to stage before the end of 2022. And what that helped us do was we said no to a ton of projects that were super interesting, that we just thought were too risky in the current environment. And we just really focused on anything that was developing opportunities that were coming up when we were really hoping that it was going, we were hoping that it was going to be giving enough time for a vaccine to come up, for the vaccine to be distributed, for everyone who wanted one to have one, and then for everyone to feel comfortable going out in public and sitting close together in dark rooms again. So far that's been working. We still feel confident. Most of our projects are actually on the timeline of 2024, 2025, and some as late as 2027, but it's allowing us to think really strategically about the way that we want to be developing our business in the future. And that's something we, even when COVID is done, we're realizing we're going to keep that COVID mentality of why do we want to do these projects, and only accepting the ones that really make sense. So all that to say, like, it sucked for everyone. It sucked for us as well. But in learning how to deal with it without jumping at every single opportunity or lifeline that seemed to present itself, I think we actually realized that it was a great growing and learning opportunity for us personally, and we think for our industry as well to some degree.
And I feel like it's a wonderful, like, enforced maternity and paternity leave for you and your girlfriend, as it was for Lindsay and I.
Absolutely. It really, really is. And the other big benefit, I think, is that everybody networked in such a more meaningful way over the last 12 months. It was no longer networking by proxy, by who had the, like, sexiest beach shot on Instagram in between their contracts. Like, it was actually people being like, I'm actually scared, and like, I don't know how I'm going to pay rent this month. And I don't, like, I mean, that to me is the strength of the circus community. It's that we're there for each other in good times. We're there for each other in bad times, but it's feeling that in the bad time is, I think, going to prepare us for a marvelous renaissance in the good times, because we're going to trust people around us more than we did before. And I think that that's kind of the silver lining for all of us who decided to stick it through and who were able and privileged enough to stick it through these last 12 months. So I'm looking forward to what comes after.
Okay, that's the perfect note to go into our final three questions that everybody gets. The first question is, has there been a piece of advice, either really good or really, really bad, that somebody has given you and has stuck with you?
The worst advice I was ever given was to negotiate as an artist under the assumption that producers are always trying to screw you over. And I did that for many, many years. And in the process just destroyed value and stopped relationships from forming when they really needed to. I think it's the worst advice I was ever given. It's just assume if you're an artist, the world is trying to take advantage of you. It's not true. Like, if you're an artist, the world needs you, but you also need the world. And so you need to err on the side of creating relationships and not being transactional and being very, very focused on building bridges with every single person around you. And negotiating like a beast doesn't do that.
I love that. I could not love that piece of advice more. I get frustrated a lot because both Josh and I came from performing first and then transitioned to producing. And when I hear conversations about with artists about, you know, like producers need to listen to us, blah, blah, blah. They don't, you know, they need us. I'm like, yeah, but you also need them. Like they're creating the show that you get to then perform your piece of art in. It's like a symbiotic relationship. One without the other doesn't exist. So I love how you just said, however you phrased it was way better than I could ever articulate.
It's funny because I feel like Lindsay and I have when it's a show that is not like a circus show where it's like act, 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 but it's more based on like an artist's body of work. So like, for example, we were part of the Misbehave game show in Vegas or, you know, with Beyond Babel, which is our dance show in New York, which is based around Keone and Mari Madrid's choreography. Like we picked artists who were also like kind of self-producers already because we knew they did not have that mentality going and we knew they understood a little bit already about what it takes to get their own work made. So it was already like, you know, in the same way where it's good for artists, for producers to that come from an artistic background, it's good in the reverse as well for artists to know a little bit about producing. So love that.
In our company, we have the unwritten rule that we only want to work with people, no matter what their role is, who have come from the world of art. So like we only would want to work with performers, former performers, whether they're coming in as riggers or costume designers. Like there's just something about the shorthand. By the way, the second one I was going to think of was don't work for free. I think it's, I understand the spirit behind it, but to be honest, like every job I've ever been happy about, I got because at some point in the past I did something for free. The reason why I love working for free is because people have really low expectations of you when you work for free. And so you can basically promise anything and put yourself in crazy risky situations that you wouldn't feel comfortable doing if they were paying you any type of salary. So that would be the second option. The second option I would have is don't work for free. I think you have to respect yourself, but you can work for free and still respect yourself if you know exactly why you're working for free.
Yeah, and all these, you know, oh my God, what is it when you're in school and you have to do an internship? I worked for free for every internship and now you have to get paid. You have to pay your intern. What is that about? No, just kidding.
Those are really excellent pieces of advice. Second question, is there a book, a movie, a TV show, any art, a painting, any artistic reference that you would give to somebody who is trying to study circus?
There's an old, I think it's from the 80s or maybe early 90s. It's a film, Hong Kong film called Painted Faces. And it tells the story of, it's autobiographical, but it tells the story of Jackie Chan and his Chinese opera siblings, like they call themselves brothers. Growing up in Hong Kong as the world was transitioning away from the live performance of Chinese opera to the Hong Kong cinema industry. And so it's basically looking at an art that's kind of dying but reinventing itself in the film world. Sammo Hung was the director and the star of that, and Sammo Hung was also one of the artists who trained with Jackie Chan in this particular school. But there was something about that film and the very emotion, it had a very strong emotional resonance with me, the way those students trained, the realities of, working in this industry isn't what I expected it to be, but I can actually change it and modify it for today and for my needs. I think there's something very interesting about that. That would be the one I would give as a reference.
Great.
I like that. We'll have to add that to our watch list.
It's on Netflix.
Amazing. So we definitely can watch it then. Where I was like, what should we watch? Now we can watch that.
That's always the Netflix question is what to watch.
What to watch, yeah. So our last question is, who do you think we should have on our podcast?
I haven't looked at everyone you have in your library yet.
It's okay. We'll tell you.
I would, have you ever spoken with any of the Swiss circus family owner operators?
No, I would love to talk to somebody from the Knies or the Knox or, the answer is essentially no.
Okay. I mean, those would be, I think, the people that everything I learned about how to make a circus show successful came from talking with these types of owner operators. I mean, they are carrying with them like 8, 9, 10 years of circus knowledge. And it's just...
You mean 8, 9, 10 generations of circus knowledge?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, these circuses have been working for 200, 250 years, successfully formed in very difficult conditions. But they know exactly how to make this business work. And speaking with them is always...
Any individual at any organization you think would be a particularly good interview?
Any would be great. I would hate to play favorites.
Okay, great. Well, we'll see who we can get. I definitely,
Josh was born in Switzerland, so.
Yeah, so we go to Switzerland when there's no COVID pretty regularly. So we've seen a lot of those Swiss shows. I'll just bring a recorder with us and just walk backstage and see who I can grab.
Yeah, no, honestly, any Swiss family circus, like the ones that I have seen most recently were Salto Natale, and Canelli, Starlight, of course, is another one that has really strong connections to the Montreal Circus School.
Is Monty Swiss, or is it?
Yeah, Monty is Swiss.
Monty is Swiss. Yeah, of course, Monty.
So many.
But you really, there's something about speaking to the one person or the two or three people, because it's often a husband and a wife, and usually the son or the daughter, who are so involved in the decision making process of everything. But they control all the bank, you know, all the money decisions, all the creative decisions, all the production decisions, all the operational decisions, and they understand better than anyone else I've ever met in the business exactly how everything fits together and why. I'll just give you one really stupid example where I was like, I went to go see the show and it was near the end of the run, and I was just astonished because every Swiss circus I saw was at like over 100% occupancy. Like they were stuffing people in. And I was just like, I just don't understand why some of these Swiss families only do 5 weeks, 6 weeks. Like, you have such amazing occupancy. Why wouldn't you extend by another week to see if you could do well? And he just looked at me and said, I'm making enough money. If I extend a week, I might have empty seats, and that's going to make everyone enjoy the show that much less. So why would I take that risk? Like, this is a perfect example for me of counterintuitive. If you're sold out over capacity for 5 weeks, the business mind says, let's open for a sixth. But the circus mind says, no, because the show you see at 101% occupancy is more than twice as good as the show you see at 80% occupancy. Like, for me, I was like, I have so much to learn in this industry still.
Well, James, thank you so much for talking with us. This has been an awesome interview. I think people are going to get a lot out of it. You dropped a lot of wisdom in here, particularly around business. And I hope it inspires people who are interested in going down a more businessy route to explore it as well. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Had a really great time, and hope to talk to you again soon.
And that was our interview. James Tanabe.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Instagram and Facebook, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Thanks and have a good week.
Catch you on the next one.
Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.